is State, oops, that's not it. State versus Farzad.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Jennifer Swigert here on behalf of the appellant, Dr. Saeed Farzad, and I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please.
All right.
We ask this court to reverse Dr. Farzad's conviction on two separate constitutional grounds. First, his statements at a Department of Health hearing were ruled admissible in violation of his Fifth Amendment privilege against coerced self-incrimination. Second, the jury instructions permitted him to be convicted of an uncharged offense in violation of his rights under the Sixth Amendment and Article 1, Section 22 of the Washington
Post. I wonder if we could start with that. I think your argument with respect to the self-incrimination issue is fairly clear in your briefs, but this is a puzzling issue because it isn't really clear what kind of an error this is, right? I mean, it sort of feels like a juror unanimity error, but nobody's talking about that. And I realize you think it's like Jane, but is it like any other case? I mean, the thing is, what kind of a case is that? Are we talking about, is this like a, the instruction didn't include all the elements case, or is it a the elements instruction didn't include all the elements? Are you saying that the name of the person is an element of the crime? What exactly are you saying? What's the problem here?
The problem here is that the evidence could theoretically support, it appears, three separate charges. And perhaps that suddenly I'm seeing it in sort of a unit of prosecution light. But he was charged with specifically, and the information specifically named the victims. And so maybe this would be a different case if that information hadn't specifically named the victims.
Yeah, but where's a case that says that there's a problem if the information gives more information than it really needs to give? I mean, the information properly alleged the elements.
That's correct.
And we're talking about which crime here? I guess telephone harassment.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
State v. Brown is the case that I would point the court to. That's also cited in my brief along with Jane.
That's a conspiracy case.
Yes, that's a conspiracy case.
Okay, so I guess what I'm struggling with is it seems like in conspiracy cases, conspiracy is a unique crime. It's not necessarily like all other crimes because of the fact that there have to be other participants, and that has been a driving feature of the cases that are revolving around a charge of conspiracy. You got any other cases where it's not conspiracy that you can talk about?
Without doing further research, no, Your Honor. But
so, I mean, that's what makes it odd, is that it seems like, you know, somehow there's a whole new line of crime here that we haven't previously encountered. It's the Brown-Jane line. You know, it's not, doesn't seem to be Petrich. It's not State versus Green. It's not, what's that leading information case? I can't think of it right now, but Kjorsvik. It's not a Kjorsvik case. At least you haven't cited Kjorsvik.
No, I don't think it is.
What is it?
I think it is that these are separate crimes against separate individuals, and there are very good reasons why the information needs to be specific enough.
Well, it charged one count.
That's correct.
All right, the count was telephone harassment. There's no problem with the way it was alleged in the information. So your client was put on notice that telephone harassment was charged.
That's correct.
Okay. And then the evidence came in, and the evidence supports. It's sufficient to support all the elements of telephone harassment. Right?
We've not challenged the sufficiency of the evidence.
No. And so then the court instructs the jury with a to-convict instruction that properly states the elements.
But it's broader than the information, and that's the problem under Jane and Brown.
Well, because it doesn't include it doesn't include the names. That's what you mean when you say it's broader. Am I correct?
Yes, that's correct.
So you're saying that whenever an information charges a crime, and in the process of charging it, itemizes the names of the people who it was charged against, that the to convict instruction must also contain those names.
Not necessarily. It's the combination of the circumstances. The combination of the circumstances that the information specifically charged the names, that the to convict instruction did not, and that then the evidence as it was presented at trial could have led the jury to convict on the basis of acts that were never charged against. There was a third separate phone call to another woman, to this Michelle Raymond.
Is that a notice argument that you're making now?
Well, notice
is a due process notice argument. You didn't tell me I had to defend against the third.
I believe that's sort of built into challenges to the breadth of the two convict instruction vis-a-vis the information. Yes,
and so in your theory, you wouldn't have this case. You wouldn't have this appeal if Raymond hadn't testified. You'd be okay with it if it was just Tyler and Tran?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe we would not have this argument if Michelle Raymond had not testified. Or if there had been other testimony about the phone call to Michelle Raymond, we might still have the same problem. It wouldn't necessarily have had to come directly from her if there was someone. But if there had been no testimony about alleged threats made in a phone call to Michelle Raymond, I don't believe we would be making this argument. That's correct.
Well, it's under Jane, you have what you consider to be a solid argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
It seems very much like Jane. And so then in Jane, you get the problem of harmless error. And I guess we have that argued here as well by the state. But when my observation about this is that when you start getting into the question of harmless error, it sounds an awful lot like what you get into with a juror or unanimity case. And yet we don't. Did you consider, may I ask, arguing this as a juror unanimity case? Because there was no Petrich instruction here.
No, that's correct.
We have one count and a couple different phone calls.
I mean, perhaps I should have, but it seemed to fit so well in with exactly what happened in Jane and Brown that seemed the most promising course of action. So that's the direction I went with it in terms of the briefing. But I can certainly see how it could be viewed as a unanimity problem as well. But the reason I think this falls directly in Brown, under Brown, is the language in Brown talks about the fact that there was all this testimony from all these different people who were potentially conspirators, and the jury might very well have stopped at the first one, which might not have been anybody who was mentioned in the information, and then found him guilty based on that. And that's the crux of the problem. In this case, Michelle Raymond's testimony was actually the first that came up. So in considering the testimony, the jury might very well have come across Michelle Raymond's account of what happened and convicted based on that.
Does the person who is on the other end of the telephone call, the recipient of the call, is that the, quote, another person who has to be the subject of the threat?
Not necessarily. I believe that
So why would it make any difference who heard it? What if it was on a speakerphone? It was heard by 18 people. Would it make any difference who actually heard it in terms of satisfying the elements?
Well, it depends on who's being threatened. And certainly harassment, I've seen harassment charges that have been upheld on the basis of threats to a third person.
If it's not a notice argument, if it's not a 14th Amendment argument, we'll talk again in 10 minutes.
May it please the Court, Seth Fine, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for Snohomish County, representing the respondent of the State of Washington. Although appellant has outlined two issues, all the time was spent talking about these jury instructions, and so unless the Court has questions on the other issue, I'll talk about that as well. And as you're aware, the state has not attempted to argue that there was no constitutional problem with this. The defendant does have the burden of showing manifest constitutional error since there was no objection, and that encompasses both the idea that there is constitutional error that is truly of constitutional magnitude, and that it resulted in some actual
prejudice. Well, before we go into that, do I understand you to say that? I mean, in Jane, which I think was also a Snohomish County case, am I right? I'm not sure. But at any rate, the state in that case conceded error because of the instruction, which was similar to the instructional situation here. Are you conceding error?
Yes, I would agree that the instruction was erroneous. As for the precise nature of that error, there is some room for disagreement. I think that
Do you have an impression of what error you're conceding made? I mean, that will help us with the next step in the analysis.
Well, yes, and now. I think that you basically identified the problem. It is a notice problem. A defendant is entitled to have notice of what the nature of the charge is, and I think there's a basic rule that a defendant who is charged under with one crime cannot be convicted of some distinct crime.
So I suppose this would be, an analogy might be that if someone is charged with murder, typically the information would say murdering John Jones. And then if you brought in facts about another murder, a different person who was allegedly murdered by the defendant, this would be a problem. It wouldn't be that you had misstated the elements of murder. It wouldn't be that your information was fallacious under Kjørsvik.
I think that's a correct analysis, assuming that hypothetically the instruction just said the defendant intentionally killed a human being and there was evidence of two different people that the defendant had killed and the information only named one of them, that there would be a problem with that instruction. There's a case coming into my mind, which unfortunately I cannot give you the name of, but the Washington Supreme Court decided one case where the defendant was charged with possessing a stolen car, and the evidence proved that he only possessed car parts, and the court held that he could not be convicted of that. So if one hypothesizes a jury instruction which allowed conviction on proof of either that he possessed a car or that he possessed car parts, that would present a problem. It is not strictly a jury unanimity problem, but it is akin to that. The analysis is similar in that you sometimes look to whether jurors might have convicted the defendant on the basis of some theory that was improperly before the court.
So it does seem like a notice problem. I mean, in other words, the defendant in this case may have come to court expecting to challenge Tran and Tyler and the credibility of their statements, and then all of a sudden here comes Raymond.
Yes, theoretically that might be true, which sort of gets into the manifest constitutional error, where if the error is purely abstract and theoretical in its effects, then it is not manifest error that can be raised for the first time on appeal. And I would suggest that if you look at this trial transcript and how this case was tried, that theoretical possibility of lack of notice essentially disappears. What you have is calls to three employees at the same office within the period of 20 minutes dealing with the same subject matter, Molina's refusal to authorize certain prescriptions, and containing similar threats. Moreover, as defense counsel told the jury in closing argument, the issue here was not what the defendant said, what words he used. The issue was the intent with which he spoke to them. Now, where is the evidence that the defendant's intent somehow radically changed between the phone call to Ms. Raymond and the phone call to Ms. Tran?
Well, I realize that's what they focused on in the argument, but I mean the jury's looking at the instruction, and they have to find the element is concerning the person threatened. I mean it's a particular person, so don't they have to find? And this is, what if six jurors thought that it was Ms. Raymond and six jurors thought it was Ms. Tyler, because Ms. Raymond was a little bit less explicit about, a little less sure about whether anybody was really targeted.
Yeah, I mean, theoretically, that would be a possibility, and if there was something in this case to suggest that possibility actually occurred,
well, I mean, I guess, I keep coming back to jury unanimity, I think it's Camarillo, the case that says in a child molestation case where there's one count and 45 acts, the fact that, you haven't really, when nobody differentiates between those and the testimony is kind of generic, then it's harmless error because either the jury believes the child witness or the jury doesn't. Okay, this isn't like that, though. There's three different witnesses, and maybe with differing levels of credibility, and they're all talking about different acts.
Well,
theoretically, that might be a problem. If you look at the reality of this case, there was no distinction between the three witnesses in terms of credibility. They all testified to the same facts and basically the same threats. Indeed, there was nothing that Ms. Raymond was threatened with that wasn't threatened with the other two witnesses. You know, she testified that the defendant was going to come down with machine guns and shoot her manager. Well, Ms. Tyler testified that the defendant was going to bring machine guns and kill everybody. And Ms. Tron testified that defendant said that he was going to shoot a director and kill everybody there. So when you look at this, at the record in this case and what the witness testified.
But what you're saying, yeah, let me just ask it this way. Is what you are saying that there is nowhere in the record where it is manifested that the jury was presented with any reason to believe the third version of events while not believing the first two?
That is what I'm saying, that there is no basis for a rational juror to say that the defendant committed the crime in the phone call to Ms. Raymond while not committing the crime in the phone call to Ms. Tran and Ms. Tyler. You know, there is evidence where a juror might say that he didn't commit the crime at all.
Was there any impeaching cross-examination of the two people who were listed in the information that was conducted that was not conducted of the third person who testified?
The challenge to the witness's credibility was all to the same effect. The defendant's statements that were admitted with regards to what he had done was to the same effect with all three. You know, his position was, you know, in his statements to police, he said, I wasn't threatening them. I was warning them of the consequences that might happen if a patient was deprived of his medication. That applied equally to all three of them. He never said, well, maybe I threatened Ms. Raymond, but I didn't threaten the other two.
And yet, in Jane, which apparently we're agreeing is factually similar here, the court reversed. Why wasn't the error harmless in Jane? I'm sure there was, you know, the money laundering went on at all the different properties. The quality of the evidence supporting the money laundering at the different properties probably wasn't that different from the one that actually affected the information.
I can't really speak to that other than the analysis has to be done on the case-by-case basis, looking at the evidence and the arguments. And I would disagree with the suggestion that the arguments that were raised don't make any difference, in the same way that a prosecutor's election of specific instances and arguments can get around a potential Petrich problem. The defense counsel's identification of what the issues really are in argument ought to be looked at this court in deciding either the manifest error or the harmless error tests, which are, you know, closely related but not identical tests.
Time is short. Let me ask you a quick question. Does this record tell us whether the trial judge read the information to the jury? It's not required, but I'm just wondering if the record tells us that. The information, of course, would have specified names of particular people.
I don't recall that, Your Honor, and I think the practice in Snohomish County is usually not to do so.
Thanks.
I wonder if I might take 10 seconds to talk about costs in this matter. The new court rule says that the evidence as to ability to pay can be presented after the court presents its decision. And in this case, without going into matters outside the record, there are potentially information that we can bring in that regard. So I'd ask the court to leave the question of costs open if you affirm. But the judgment should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have just really three points on rebuttal. First, I think this really does actually come down to notice.
You had what, two or
2 minutes?
Okay, thank you. I can't seem to focus on the clock this morning.
I believe, as Judge Becker pointed out, I think notice is sort of at the crux of the rule described in Jane and Brown, that the to convict instruction can't be any broader than the information. And, you know, Counsel, Mr. Fine points out that there's little difference in the testimony regarding these three different phone calls, but we can't know what testimony might have been offered, what might have been elicited on cross-examination had that notice been given as to the third.
If we can't know, does that mean that it does not manifest itself in the record?
No, Your Honor, and here's why. Judge Becker keeps talking about whether this is a jury unanimity issue. Well, in the jury unanimity realm, we look at whether the record affirmatively shows that the verdict was unanimous. And in this case, because of the testimony that was presented, because of the two-convict instruction that was broader than the information, the record does not affirmatively show that the jury unanimously agreed that Dr. Farzad was guilty based on one of the phone calls to Ms. Tyler or Ms. Tran. So we do have a manifest error in that the record does not affirmatively show that the jury convicted based on one of the charged incidents. On the contrary, it's very similar to Brown, where the jury could very easily have just been going through the testimony, stopped at the first one that seems to fit the bill, and convicted based on an incident that was not charged in the information. And that brings up precisely the scenario from Jane and Brown and the Sixth Amendment violation that was discussed in that case. And so we would ask the court to reverse based on that particular issue and also based on the violation of his Fifth Amendment rights with the admission of the coerced statements.
Do you have anything to say about the state's request about costs?
I hadn't prepared to talk about costs today, I have to admit, Your Honor.
Thank you. Okay. That's that. Our next case this morning, guardianship of SHR.